Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Nicholas Hamasevich, Director of Research and Academic Affairs at KEI, and I will be your host today. In this episode, we talk with Stephen Denny and Christopher Green about their academic paper series report for KEI on Reed Effector press conferences. Between 2011 and 2013, North Korea held press conferences with people who supposedly defected from North Korea to South Korea, only to return back to North Korea. Stephen Denny is a doctoral student in the Department of Political Science at the University of Toronto. He holds an MA in Global Affairs and Policy from Yonsei University and a BA in Political Science from Harding University. He is also a columnist for The Diplomat and the managing editor for SinoNK.com. Christopher Green is a PhD candidate at Leiden University in the Netherlands. He received his MA from the University of Nottingham in the UK. You may also know his work as Manager of International Affairs for the online publication Daily NK and as co-editor of Sino-NK. Stephen Denny, Christopher Green, and I discuss how North Korea used the Reed Effector press conferences as an information management tool, the themes and messages the North Korean government was trying to portray through these press conferences, how North Korean defectors living in South Korea reacted after being shown videos of the press conferences, and much more. Christopher Green, Stephen Denny, thank you for joining us on Korean Context. Chris, what time period are we looking at here? And briefly describe for our listeners what these Reed Effector press conferences are.
Okay, we're looking at a time period starting in late 2011 and going through to the end of 2013. We are defining this as the Kim Jong-un or the early Kim Jong-un transition period. And what we are referring to with the term Reed Effector press conferences is a press conference held in Pyongyang featuring individuals from North Korea who left the country, escaped, defected, mostly to South Korea, but some didn't get that far, and then returning to North Korea. The question of return is an open one. How did they go back? Why did they go back? Were they coerced? All of these questions are pertinent, but just as long as that individual left the country and then later returned, that's a Reed Effector, and at least 20 of them have appeared in Reed Effector press conferences in that period, 2011 to 2013.
Stephen, one of the things I thought was interesting in the presentation of your paper at KEI was your explanation of how academic theory can help us do a couple of things when we're looking at North Korea. And one of those things that you mentioned was better explaining how a country like North Korea survives and hasn't collapsed yet. And one of those ways was the propaganda and information management. Can you talk a little bit about some of the theories you guys were working with in the paper and how we should be using these theories or looking at these theories when we are looking at the Reed Effector press conferences?
It's sort of the million-dollar question or the perennial question. Why does the show go on despite the many exogenous and endogenous shocks to North Korea's political system? The 1990s was a time where many predictions were made about the certain demise of North Korea, of the state, and of the inevitable unification that would come post-collapse. But it's still there. And this was not just a question concerning North Korea. The 90s was a time when scholars, practitioners, and others thought that the transition to liberal democracy or some close variation thereof was inevitable. You remember the famous thesis, The End of History, by Francis Fukuyama, which posited that with the end of the Cold War signified the triumph of liberal democracy and the inevitable transition towards this political system the world over. The same could be applied to North Korea. Yet, as elsewhere in the world, same goes for North Korea, that did not exactly happen. So in political science specifically, a new study arose, the study of the politics of authoritarianism. And in our paper, we discuss different authors who made an attempt to answer the question, why are authoritarian political systems so durable? And they basically found and concluded that party states in particular are resilient. And it's because of the certain strengths and the capacity of party states. And you'll notice that in the presentation, in the paper itself, we refer to North Korea as a party state. And that means that it's led by a single authoritarian party. There are other minor parties in North Korea, but for all intents and purposes, they're irrelevant. The one most relevant party is the Korean Workers' Party. And through that party, the show goes on, essentially, that individuals, if you want to succeed, do well in life, hold positions of power, of policymaking, and so on, you must join the Korean Workers' Party. And through that, there are certain some costs. So once you devote yourself to the party, you're hitched for life. There is no divorce. If divorce means death or something closely approximating that. And this was found by Barbara Geddes, first and foremost. But it was followed up by in several other studies by Stephen Levitsky and Lucan Wei, who found that it's not just single-party states, as in North Korea and elsewhere, but single-party states that have a revolutionary tradition. These types of regimes are particularly resilient because they draw upon their revolutionary past, which manifests itself in many ways, which shores up the capacity of the state to rule and survive through hardships and certain types of shocks. In addition to the research on party states and revolutionary party states, you also have research on hereditary succession and how, contrary to expectation, hereditary succession does not actually create instability, but is a mechanism through which elites are able to rally, because they're basically able to bury their interests, their political divides, and varying interests, and focus on the leader and the transition from, let's say, father to son. Jason Brownlee, who we cite in the article and was referenced briefly in the presentation, studied the Middle East, and he found that of the many regimes in the Middle East wherein hereditary succession took place, he found that, contrary to expectation, it actually created relative stability rather than instability. And the same could be said for North Korea. So looking at all those together, you can see that there are quite powerful and portable explanations for why authoritarian regimes are quite durable.
And so one of the things you're talking about is the way that North Korea or other countries are trying to manufacture consent by their people, right? And so one of the ways that you're looking at it is in that process of norms or normative process and coercion and utilitarian incentives. Can you kind of break that down and talk about what we should be looking for when we're looking at these Reed Effector press conferences?
So what we're looking for is the alternative ways by which a state, party state in this case, is capable of establishing what can and cannot be done in society, what should and should not be expected. And it's a manufacturing through the careful curation of information, a consensus with society, and the construction of a particular understanding between the state and society about what they can and cannot do. This goes beyond, and we emphasize this point in the paper and in the presentation, beyond the state-centric literature though, summarized previously, because it takes it to the level of society, and it brings us to the interaction between the state and society.
So when we're looking at press conferences, you guys point to some themes and messages that you feel North Korea is trying to portray. Can you take us through what you found, what you think some of those themes and messages are that seem to be portrayed in these press conferences?
Well, in our presentation, we broke it down to indicate the ways in which these press conferences reveal changes to government policy. We had four different specific thematic changes between the Kim Jong-il era policy towards defectors and the Kim Jong-un era policy towards defectors. Whereas, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the olden days, in the era of Kim Jong-il, the idea that South Korea could be a more developed society, a richer society where people made more money, where mass welfare was generally better, was completely negated. This is, of course, going back to the 1980s and early 90s rather than the contemporary era. Nowadays, instead, the Kim Jong-un government accentuates the idea that whilst we agree, they acknowledge that South Korea is all of those things, they suggest that North Korean defectors don't get a piece of that pie. They can't get a piece of that pie. Their lives are below the poverty line. They are people on the bottom rungs of society. So if you go to South Korea, you'll be on the bottom rungs of society, but if you stay here, there'll be equality, which is, of course, the socialist myth in and of itself.
So that was going from negating the superiority of South Korea and accentuating now defectors' underclass status in South Korean society. In addition to that, you also see a focus away from considering people who leave North Korea as traitors to considering people who leave North Korea as mistake makers. So before, it was if you left North Korea, if you defected, you were a turncoat, no longer worthy of state support or love from the people and the leader. What's emphasized is that they've simply made a mistake. They're made out to be more human. And that is significant as far as we know. In times past, defectors are people who would leave the country would be considered as traitors. That doesn't seem to be the case any longer, as we see through the defector press conferences. Another thematic shift is from blaming the individual to blaming someone else. So before, if the individual left, it was his or her own fault for leaving. Whereas now, they're seen as being the victim and thus sort of innocent of a scheming or conniving religious pastor or religious group, or of them falling victim to the machinations of U.S. and South Korean intelligence agents. There's a phrase that comes up in almost every conference: they were dragged to the South. So they find them like they're in China, which is key to emphasize here, and is emphasized in the redefector press conferences, to make money. So they're in China seeking profit, not necessarily because they're bad citizens or traitors, but because they needed to make money, and well, now that's okay. But while they were seeking profit, they were captured and dragged to the South. So that's a key thematic shift.
And it paints the Manchurian borderland between North Korea and China. The border itself may be porous, but there is an image being created of the borderland as a place of danger and darkness where one cannot be sure what will happen. So you're better off just not going there. Here is safe, here we know what's going on, over there, well, no, all bets are off. It's that kind of narrative.
And the last thematic shift is from damnation to forgiveness. Whereas before, if you left, if you were a traitor, a turncoat, of course you're not welcome back. But now, because you're a mistake maker, and you fell victim to the machinations of these others, you can be forgiven for these things. Because, you know, at the end of the day, it wasn't really your fault. Perhaps you were seeking profit in China, which is not great because you should stay in the motherland, but because it wasn't entirely your fault that you wound up in South Korea, you will be welcomed back with open arms. And that's a theme that's played up at the end of basically every press conference in some form or another, because of the generosity of Kim Jong-un, or because of the loving nature of the motherland, they were able to return and resume their lives as they were before.
One of the other things I thought was interesting was the different styles of press conferences that North Korea tried with these defectors. Early on, you guys mentioned they have like a real kind of press conference style where the redefector is behind a table, they have a whole bunch of microphones in front of them, but then it kind of shifts to the style where there's a bunch of chairs, and they're all kind of sitting around next to each other, and more of a talk show or conference style. Why do you think North Korea was making those changes in that style of press conference?
I perceive it to have been a learning process on their part. In the beginning, one could see in the press conferences in a large venue, as you said, a bank of microphones, lots of, well, by North Korean standards, lots of international journalists present to hear this tale from the redefector. This appears to have been a learning process from the international style of press conferences. That's how press conferences go in Western countries or in the international community. Later, the shift towards a more comfortable setting, a more intimate setting, with sofas, coffee tables, and a sort of a communal self-criticism but confessional atmosphere, seems to have been a progression from one to the other to try and convey that message, especially, specifically the message that these people made mistakes, here they are to explain themselves, and then we can move forward now that they've returned to the embrace of the state.
Stephen, how about you?
I agree with everything Chris said. There's a certain sense of propriety in the type of venue that's set up, in both styles, and in the way they were first put together. It confers a sense of legitimacy because it's following well-established practices and standard operating procedures, if you will. So whatever they say seems more legitimate in a way. It confers a sense of truthiness to it. And so I'm sure, well, I cannot be sure because I'm not talking to those who are responsible for putting it together, but I'm willing to go out on a limb and say that they had that in mind. They watch carefully how others do things, and they seek to replicate them so as to confer a sense of legitimacy to the process itself. It is interesting that they decided to change venues and styles. Chris and I think that it has as much to do with the perceived their sought-after impact as it does with the resources that are required to host a conference with both foreign and domestic reporters and large tables with a bunch of microphones and simultaneous translations going on. It takes a lot of time, effort, manpower, so forth. Whereas the roundtable discussions are much easier to put together, or so it would seem. And it generates also a much more intimate atmosphere whereby self-criticism can be done, but it can be done in a way that doesn't seem to diminish the individual too much. Mm. They feel they're sorry for what they did. They want to seek forgiveness for it, but it's not a sort of act that results in the losing of face. And they get quite good at the end in terms of performance is concerned. Mm. Not good in terms of anything else, really. It's quite sad in many ways, the content of these Redefector press conferences. But the way in which they're manufactured and the way in which they're put together, you can see a certain learning curve throughout all of them and a learning process that took place by... So by the time the last conference, Redefector press conference, took place in 2013, I don't want to say they had it down to a science, but you knew what to expect. And if you know what to expect, it means that they've learned how to do it.
But also it means that the impact is diminishing. Mm. And the law of diminishing returns is in effect. And certainly, what the initial press conferences were big, there were lots of international... There were lots of things which couldn't be entirely controlled by the organizers. By the end, the more intimate settings, it could be entirely controlled.
One of the things that was interesting was you had a Redefector appear in two different conferences. You kind of had her appear at the beginning, and she was one of the first ones, if not the first one, and then kind of later toward the end, she reappears again. What do you think was going on there with her?
I think the most interesting point about it was the way in which she revealed some changes to her situation as a consequence of her return. In the first press conference, and it was indeed the first one, she commented on her origins and her hardships and her return, all of the themes that we elucidated earlier on in this podcast. In the last one, she was there to contribute to the discussion with the new character, the new Redefector, and to explain that now she lives in Pyongyang, she has this improved life, her son is doing well in his work, and so on and so forth. So that's a narrative shift, right? She's gone from this person who's just returned, and now she has accomplished, or she has been given, rather, is a better way to put it, all of these comforts by the state. So that's just narrative progression. Very interesting point.
Right.
It's also worth pointing out that not only does she appear twice, in the first and the last, incidentally, but she's also referenced throughout in other Redefector press conferences.
Okay.
After seeing Park Jong-suk, her name, I decided that it was time to return home, or something to that effect.
One of the things you guys did was to try to see how these press conferences were being viewed or might be viewed in North Korea, and so you interviewed other defectors.
Yeah, we took a small sample. It was only 10 interviews. We did in-depth interviews with these individuals. We drew them from various age cohorts. So I haven't got my notes in front of me, but as I recall, it was two in their 20s, four or so in their 30s, a couple in their 50s, so we were covering the spread in that respect. We asked them expressly about their socioeconomic conditions 3 years prior to their defection, and we found we had a good spread of socioeconomic conditions. So some people who had led really quite good lives, able to purchase more or less anything that they had wanted in terms of consumer goods and such, whilst they were living in North Korea, right through to people who struggled to survive. And we drew them from different areas of the country. Of course, there is a limitation in this respect because the overwhelming majority of North Korean defectors do come from the border region. But we still managed to get two from Pyongyang, two from inland cities, and then the rest from cities nearish to the North Korean border with China, but going all the way across from North Pyongan province in the west up to Rasan in the northeast.
And for these North Korean defectors that you interviewed, it seemed that they thought that in some ways these press conferences and themes and messages that North Korea was trying to portray would work.
Yes, that's absolutely right. They revealed to us a great deal of knowledge of the falsehoods and half-truths which are peddled by the North Korean media on a regular basis. Their media consumptive behavior was generally quite varied. These people were by no means fools. Nevertheless, they all told us that because there is a kernel of truth to the fact that North Korean defectors in South Korea do genuinely struggle in a lot of cases, this redefector press conference concept would be able to transcend the inherent problems of the North Korean media and still have an effective impact. Now, these were, of course, defectors. And at the very least, I mean, the most recent defector left in July 2012, so has had a significant amount of time outside the country. So, of course, caveats apply.
Sure.
But that was a really interesting point, that just because of the message that was being sent out to the ordinary North Korean people, there was a chance of it having an effective reception, yeah.
So this takes us back to the concept of a normative domain consensus, that which we focused on in our research. The process whereby the party state uses a particular information management strategy so as to establish a reciprocity of expectations between ordinary citizens and the state, which has, as Max Weber famously told us, a monopoly on the use of physical force or violence. So it's this process whereby the state defines what it can do and what citizens can expect it to do and what the state permits citizens to do and what expects them to do.
So these North Korean defectors that you interviewed, they point out some of the ways or some of the particular people or groups in North Korea that they think would be most susceptible to believing or at least listening more to the press conferences than others. Can you talk a little bit about those groups and those types of people?
Yeah, sure. The results we received suggest that a person's age and social status is extremely relevant. Access to contravening information. So if the question we're positing is who is most likely to be positively, from a North Korean government perspective, affected by this press conference content, then we are talking about people who do not have alternative sources of information which provide them the ability to compare their lives with the lives of others, both inside and outside the country. So that means people in the interior of the country would be more likely to accept this information than people in the borderlands or in Pyongyang or near the border with South Korea who have access to external media of some form or another. Another important distinction is in terms of age and social status. In terms of age, I think it's fairly self-evident that an older person with a more conservative mindset would be more likely to take North Korean media content at face value than a younger person. Now, of course, younger people are also more likely to be accessing external media. So there's a close link between those two.
Right.
Social status is interesting because a number of our interviewees pointed out that people working in certain sectors of the economy would be more likely to accept the information at face value because of the circumstances under which they worked, by which we mean people in the military who are subject to harsh discipline and a constant stream of fairly abrasive propaganda. People working in textile mills was one that was mentioned. In mines was another one that was mentioned. People working in mining areas would, we were told, tend not to access external media anyway, partly because they're in the wrong socioeconomic cohort to be accessing that stuff, but also because that's just not what happens in mining regions. So there's the distinctions are very clear.
So one of the things that the messaging was portraying was that if you, the North Korean defector, go to South Korea, you are going to be less affluent. You're not going to have that much money. You're not going to have a good job. But this contact from the North Korean defectors in South Korea back to families or friends often includes kind of money and remittances. So wouldn't that draw out the aspect that, no, people really do have money in South Korea when they go?
Yes, absolutely. It certainly would. It is clear from our results that people who have family members in South Korea not only do they receive remittances in a lot of cases, but they also have direct channels of information, and they will have a much more nuanced view of what life in South Korea is really like. In addition, they will receive remittances. In such cases, that will give them a material existence which is superior to a lot of their contemporaries, their peers in society. That's not going to be hidden from the wider society. People are going to know that this family has a defector living in South Korea. These remittances are improving their material existence substantially.
Adding on to what Christopher just said, it's worth pointing out that though there is a kernel of truth to the message that defectors living in South Korean society are the underclass, they are still relatively better off. And according to the data that is collected and disseminated by the Hana Foundation, who conducts yearly public opinion surveys, yearly surveys of defectors in South Korea, asking them a range of questions from how happy are you to are you making more money than you did last year, find that not only are they steadily making more money, but overall, they're relatively happy. So everything is relative here. That, yes, they are not as well-to-do as an ordinary South Korea, because of course they're not. They came from a very different society, they're uprooted, they're going through the process of assimilation. And that for those who have direct lines of communication between North Korea and South Korea, that message is almost certainly transmitted that, well, it's harder here. Economic competition under a capitalist system is more difficult than it was where we were before, but we're making it and we're relatively happy.
Did the North Korean defectors that you interview talk about maybe ways to contradict or combat the messages that were in the press conferences?
You know, we didn't really ask them about that, but I dare say they've got their own opinions.
So for you guys, how do you think South Korea or the United States should try to combat those messages, or should they try and combat those messages?
I don't think in a liberal democracy it's advisable to try and combat those messages directly through nefarious means or through counter-propaganda. Hopefully, society will do that for them in due course. As Stephen just mentioned, surveys show that life, material life for defectors and defector families in South Korea is slowly but steadily improving. They have better networks. Of course, life in South Korea is network-driven a lot of the time. They have better networks, they're getting better jobs, they're getting better education. Of course, this is partly a result of a completely different cohort of defectors. As you know, back in the 90s during the famine, the people who defected came from different socioeconomic backgrounds to the people who defect these days. These days, there's a lot more strategic decision-making going on. There's a lot more chain defections in the contemporary era than there used to be, which means that those networks are ready-made, and of course that leads to quicker improvements in life situation. So let us assume that in the fullness of time, this question will answer itself. If we're talking about combating those messages inside North Korea, then I think there's a very, very big role to play for those external organizations which are sending information into North Korea, of which there are many. They're working really hard, a lot of them in Seoul, some here in Washington, D.C., sending in radio signals. I mean, we recently read a story about how the BBC was considering setting up a world service for the Korean Peninsula. What a great story that would be if that took place. Organizations like Daily NK, which are getting stories out of North Korea and then sending them via the radio stations back in, so people in different regions of the country are learning about material conditions and social events, accidents and incidents all over the country, things that their own media wouldn't be telling them. Of course, there's a lot of space left for us to ramp up these things. And so I think there's plenty of room for more investment to try and get those messages to more people.
When you ask what can South Korea do to counter the message, I would agree with Chris that you don't want the South Korean government to adopt a similar strategy, a form of counter-propaganda where perhaps as in the 90s, defectors would be required to go on KBS, I think it was, and basically denounce North Korea's political system and exalt South Korea's. Rather, as Chris suggested, society will hopefully do that rather than the state. But what the state can do and what the state is doing and has been doing is finding the best way to open up the opportunities for defectors to acquire specifications and skills that will allow them to succeed in South Korean society. On that account, South Korea is doing all right. Many people would say it's not doing great.
Could do better, but is doing quite a lot.
Yes. Right. And it's also a great opportunity for civil society and NGOs to assist in the integration process, the process of assimilation that defectors are going through in South Korean society, because for all intents and purposes, North and South Korea, despite sharing a common Korean history, are two different countries, two different societies in many ways.
Why do you think the press conferences stopped? Why do you think we haven't had more of these re-defector press conferences from North Korea?
Of course, we don't know. We don't have the inside track on their decision-making. But we have seen by watching North Korea over a lot of years that they do have some trouble sustaining public policy over the long term, any given policy. It's easy to start, but these things peter out. It's not only North Korea in which this is true. I mean, this is true in a lot of places. So it could just simply be that they ran out of steam on this particular narrative. But we did also notice that as those press conferences were continuing, the North Korean state was also following parallel tracks. They were creating stories, video documentaries about senior defectors in South Korea and trying to completely negate their stories and tell the quote-unquote true story, the most famous being, of course, the sad story of Shin Dong-hyuk, where they seized upon a kernel of truth in his story and made it much bigger, made a documentary, and that led to, of course, ramifications in South Korea and here in America as well. So they followed parallel tracks, and they may just have thought that there was a shift to be made at that time. In addition, coming into 2014, the COI report was a major external shock to their system, and there probably had to be a propaganda reboot to try and address that more directly in a way that a re-defector press conference really couldn't do.
Any other thoughts or things that we need to talk about or realize when we're looking at the press conferences and the information management in North Korea?
One thing that might satisfy a comment for both Chris and I is that we should be careful when we use the word propaganda. What we are witnessing here is certainly propaganda, but the word has lost its original and true meaning, which was applied to basically all states to cover the ways in which they would manage information for all sorts of things, from promotion of certain social etiquette to ways of doing business to how to conduct yourself as a true patriot. But the word propaganda has taken on a much more nefarious connotation and is often used when describing the manipulation only of information by countries like North Korea. So I think that's one thing to keep in mind. And that's the reason why we were so adamant on using the phrase information management strategy rather than propaganda.
I know that here in DC, a lot of people don't have time, just their daily lives are too busy to really engage with theory. But in some ways, the theory that underpins this working paper we produced for KAI is very pertinent. Thomas Kalagi is not the only person to have addressed the information strategies of dictatorial regimes. His framework may not even be the best, but it is a really pertinent one in this case with the normative, the coercive, and the utilitarian consensuses and the way they interact to create the state's message to the people. If you want to read North Korea, if you want to understand the North Korean propaganda that goes out, you have to put it into a framework, or otherwise you do end up thinking, well, this is just a strange or a crazy or an illogical country. It's none of those things. It's difficult to understand, but if you come at it with a decent framework and you try and plug in the information into your framework, you'll end up with a better understanding of the country. And from there, you can go forward and make better policy.
Further to that, if we use theory in a productive and good way, it also opens up opportunities to put North Korea into comparative perspective. By putting things into comparative perspective, it can shine light on those common traits, and it can lead to a better understanding for something like why there is this commonality amongst certain authoritarian regimes, which is related to their durability despite the different hardships and shocks they face.
Well, Christopher Green, Stephen Denny, thank you so much for joining us on Korean Context. We really enjoyed the conversation.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.
Our guests today were Stephen Denny and Christopher Green, authors of the KAI Academic Paper Series report, The Whisper in the Ear, Re-defector Press Conferences as an Information Management Tool. Thank you so much for listening to KAI's Korean Context podcast, and we hope you'll join us again next time.